Welcome to the Michelle Mission, Two Men, One Podcast, every black film ever made. My name is Vincent Williams, and I'm joined as always by my partner.
Hey, holla at your boy. This is Len, a.k.a. the Bat Tribble.
And we have been so fortunate this year that we are in the fifth week of Octavia April, the month that we devote to Afrofuturism slash black science fiction. And we are going to end our month with 2023's The Marvels.
The Marvels!
Directed by Nia DaCosta, written by Nia DaCosta, Megan McDonald, and Alyssa Karasik. It stars Brie Lawson in the title role as Captain Marvel, who finds herself and her powers entangled with Kamala Khan and Monica Rambeau, forcing them all to work together to save the universe. Besides Lawson, it also stars Tiana Parrish, Iman Vellani, and a strong supporting role by one Samuel L. Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
This was the choice of Lynn Webb. But before we see just how marvelous the Marvels are, how are you, Lynn?
I'm doing great. Vincent, how about yourself?
I am also doing well.
Oh, thank you. Well. Shout out to each and every one of you out there who are watching us live as we stream from Yunk Junk, Philadelphia's premier video podcast palace here in Manayunk, PA, streaming to Facebook, streaming to Twitter, as well as to YouTube, where all of you are out there in the chat. Hello, missionaries.
Good evening, one and all.
I see that George Kimona has asked a question, Vincent. He wants to know what's going on with the chairs.
We're doing different things. We're doing chair things.
Yeah.
Doing chair things.
Yeah, we're chairing.
You're just doing chair things.
Yeah. Where do I go? Look, we're going to jump right into the show, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to... The beautiful thing about The Marvels, the movie that we're reviewing,
yes,
is that I actually found it a refreshing movie.
Oh.
And I'll tell you why when we get to the review.
Oh, it's a preview of the review.
Yes.
It's a preview of the review.
Exactly. And in a preview of the review, I'm going to jump right into the show.
All right.
And that means we're going to hear from you, ladies and gentlemen, your missives from the missionaries.
Right.
So what else is going on, Lynn?
We have emails, Vincent.
Ooh, missives from the missionaries.
Missives from the missionaries, ladies and gentlemen. We have an email, Vincent, from Courtney.
Hey, Courtney.
Hello to the Michelle men, Len and Vincent. Hope all is well and that you both have a blessed week.
Mm-hmm.
Before I get into initial post, I just want to say Crooklyn by Spike Lee might as well be grouped with Mo Better Blues in terms of a chill, cozy vibe.
I respectfully disagree with you, Courtney.
Yeah. Like,
Crooklyn is nice and warm and fuzzy, but all the way up until the exact second that it's not.
I know. And the same for Mo Better Blues.
Same for Mo Better.
Right. Because I'm sitting there like,
right.
I don't remember that about Crooklyn, but Mo Better Blues takes a turn.
Right.
Real early.
Right. You know, that moment has my greatest little character kind of detail in movies ever.
What, in Mo Better Blues?
In Mo Better Blues. So, spoiler, at some point, something bad happens. And Wesley Snipes
the blues.
Plays a jazz musician named Shadow.
Mm-hmm.
And throughout the film, he's been sort of the frenemy, antagonist, you know, this sort of, you know, kind of adds the gristle.
Right.
To the meat that is in Mo Better Blues. And when this something bad happens, he has on a suit.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a resplendent suit, and he has a pocket square and a hat on, so he looks great. And he goes in, and his friend is bloody.
Mm-hmm.
And Wesley Snipes is, you know, he's like, oh, my friend is, you know, bloody. You know, somebody call an ambulance, call 911. And he goes, and he reaches for his pocket square to wipe the blood off. But then there's like this split second where it's like, yeah, I don't want to get my pocket square all bloody.
Exactly.
And then he reaches in his suit and pulls out a handkerchief. It's a split second. You know, I have to say, in full disclosure, I didn't notice it maybe the first three times I watched the movie because it happens in like a second. But now that I've seen it,
can't not see it.
And it's one of those questions that if I ever meet Spike Lee and or Wesley Snipes, I'm going to ask.
Yes.
Was that your idea or was that his idea?
I guarantee that was Wesley's idea.
That was Wesley Snipes?
Guarantee that was Wesley's idea.
Because it's glorious.
It is. It is. Mm-hmm. I remember in a review, because by then you had noticed
it. Right, by then I knew it. Right,
so pointed it out. Right. And I was like, yeah, I kind of noticed that too. Right. I was like, yeah. I definitely think that's Wesley Snipes, because Wesley Snipes, I think, is a very underappreciated actor.
Right.
Like, just brings like little small little details to this thing.
Little split second of character building.
Yeah. That's cool. Courtney continues.
Okay.
A conversation that is worth having is deciding on which is better.
Okay.
Satire or comedy.
Okay.
What prompted me was stumbling across two Eddie Murphy specials, Delirious and Raw. And to be fair, Delirious is actually a special. It was an HBO special.
Mm-hmm.
Raw was a feature film.
Yes, it was.
That was released.
Directed by Robert Townsend.
While people give praise to Eddie Murphy's charisma and energy, people have to admit that a good chunk of the comedy is very dated and doesn't hold up. Comedy is like fashion. If it doesn't evolve, it can be left behind. Mm. I also believe comedy has to be smart in not only message, but approach as well. Mm-hmm. It's a no-brainer that comedy from the 70s and 90s doesn't hold up as well. Satire, on the other hand, is poking fun at the societal issues and their discrepancies. A movie like Hollywood Shuffle still works because, unfortunately, there has been little progression when it comes to Black actors in a space like Hollywood. Basically, satire, in my opinion, can fare better than comedy. I would love to hear your thoughts on satire versus comedy. Looking forward to this week's episode.
Okay. What do you think, satire or comedy?
Well, I think that good satire definitely has a longer shelf life than dated or bad comedy.
Yeah.
Because there is comedy that, and there is even some comedy that may have a little bit of, you know, datedness to it.
Right. And are we talking about stand-up comedy?
Well, I think
because the two examples she used
was like stand-up comedy. Yeah. See, and I'm thinking about more just comedy in general,
right,
as opposed to stand-up comedy. But like a good there's some comedy, what I was going to say, like some comedy may have like a little bit of datedness to it, but if it is done well, if it, you know, funny is funny for the most part,
right,
as long as it's not punching down or just overly over the top, silly and stupid.
Look, just a week ago, I was looking at a clip from the Carol Burnett show where Vicki Lawrence goes off script. It was like the Mama's Family, which is one of the ongoing bits on the Carol Burnett show. Mm-hmm. And Vicki Lawrence goes off script.
Mm-hmm.
And Carol Burnett is trying her best not to break.
Oh, my God. Oh.
And then in the midst of, she actually says, like, she's trying to signal Vicki Lawrence, you know, and she says, you know, Mama, you're going, because Vicki Lawrence plays her mother. She's like, Mama, you're going too far. That's not even on the menu. And of course, you know, Vicki Lawrence then just goes in for the kill.
She goes.
And it is so funny.
Is that the one where they, like, the entire, like, family just lost it?
Well, here's the thing. It's a bunch of examples. Because Tim Conway, I don't even know how they worked with him.
Oh, my God. There are two classic Carol Burnett skits with Tim Conway. I mean, there's tons of them.
Right.
But there is one, speaking of when they used to do the Mama's Family part, there's one where They're playing, I think, charades or something like that. And Tim Conway goes off on this long story about an elephant.
About an elephant,
that
right.
Gets like something stuck in his snout. And they lose it on the stage.
Yeah. And just before we start taping, Lynn and I were talking about Red Fox and LaWanda Page working together. And it like there are certain episodes of Sanford and Son that are immaculate.
Yeah.
In the play between these actors. So, yeah. You know, but like you, I think satire, when it's done well, probably is more far reaching.
Yeah.
And lasts longer. You know, Courtney mentioned Hollywood Shuffle, which I said when we reviewed it, like I think about Hollywood Shuffle at least once every couple of weeks when I see something and I say, you know, there's work at the post office.
Yep.
So
yep.
I guess our controversial take is that good work is what sustains.
Yeah. And it's interesting she was.
You all write that down. Good work is what sustains.
It's interesting she mentioned the Eddie Murphy specials because I remember years ago introducing the specials, introducing Raw to a friend of mine who had never seen Raw.
Mm-hmm.
And this being probably the first time that I had seen it in years myself.
Mm-hmm.
It's so thinking I'm going to be sitting down to like, yeah, we're going to be cracking the hell up.
Right.
And it was very dated and Raw has a level of misogyny that is like really, really gross from today's lens. And even this lens, and this was maybe about 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And as I'm watching it, cause my friend was just like, you know, like, I don't see what's so funny. Yeah. Even as I'm watching, I'm like, ooh.
Yeah.
Wow. But conversely, I then introduced them to Richard Pryor.
Sure.
Live on the Sunset Strip.
Mm-hmm.
Even older comedy.
Mm-hmm.
Laughing butts off.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is so much. It's and you know, Richard, he can go there, you know, sure, talking about people, sure, but there's a vulnerability in how he's exactly, putting it out there.
Exactly.
It's totally different beast mechanism.
Yeah.
All right, Court. I hope we answered your question there.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you for that email. Mm-hmm. Let's see. I marked the emails that we're going to be reading today.
We got
email from Michael Sykes.
Hey, what's up, Michael?
The subject line is the fish that saved Pittsburgh / the Spinners.
All right.
Hey, Len and Vincent. Last Saturday, a movie theater 30 minutes away from my house was actually showing The Fish That Saved Pittsburgh.
Wow.
Before I watched it, I listened to your podcast episode on the movie, in which I enjoyed and made me want to check it out. Dr. J is not a good actor.
Yes. That's
very true. I must say, though, it is one of those movies you watch on a lazy Saturday afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
It was okay.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. J's acting makes LeBron James' acting in Space Jam 2 look like Denzel Washington and Malcolm X with that horrible, uninspiring speech. Look.
It's not that
bad. I'm not going to have but so much Dr. J slander. He is that bad.
Please, Moses.
Yeah. Vincent.
Yes, sir.
Did you notice that the guy who played the DJ in the movie was the same guy who played that Uncle Tom racist cop in Boys in the Hood?
Yes, I did.
Yes.
I know exactly who you're talking about. Yes.
His name is Jesse Lawrence Ferguson.
Okay.
I've noticed the Spinners made a cameo appearance, and the Spinners wasn't that good when Philip Nguyen left the group. The group went downhill. Vincent, how you feel about it?
Love your fan, Michael.
Okay, I'm gonna get in trouble with some older missionaries in my and perhaps even in my house. I love Felipe Nguyen, but I never really thought Felipe Nguyen leaving the Spinners was the disaster that people have played it up to be. Like I think the other singers in the Spinners carried it just fine.
What were the hits after him?
Oh, I don't know off the top of my head. I'm not like.
Did they have significant? Yeah. Okay, yeah. I'm not a big Spinner.
And even the hits with Felipe Nguyen, it's not just Felipe Nguyen singing.
It's the combination.
Right, it's a combination. Like, it was never, you know, I always felt like the Spinners were more Dennis Edwards Temptations, where like all the singers were involved. Like, Dennis is clearly the lead, but like it's other people. As opposed to the David Ruffin Temptations.
Where it's
like, you know, I am David Ruffin and these are the Temptations.
Hmm.
But I also know that is controversial among Spinners fans. So okay. I tend to stay in my lane. But I take the spinners anywhere I can get them.
All right.
All right. There you go.
Thank you, Michael.
This has been 70s soul talk.
How about some Afrofuturism talk with Michael Lockett?
All right.
Len and Vincent, I am not certain how you came up with the Octavia April idea, but it slaps.
Oh, good. I'm glad.
I that would be bumping, banging, or hot for any old heads.
See, that's what the young people say.
Being a lover of sci-fi and horror, this whole month was in my wheelhouse, and the more I listened to the podcast and watched flicks, the more I wanted. I got greedy. My travels back in time took me to a place where Afrofuturism aligned perfectly with the now. I listened first to the Definition of a Black Film remix.
Okay.
You two have been and remain true to your mission. Your critiques are honest and high caliber. Sometimes there's a little too roughneck, Len. Excuse the fuck out of me. I was then set up perfectly for the binge lounge Black Panther. This brought back so many memories of reading the comics, being inspired to create characters that look like me and dreaming of what could be. The Black Panther films and the diaspora's many other creative works are diamonds and gold that we are mining for ourselves. Still being greedy, I listened to and happily rewatched The Wiz.
Okay, all right.
Thank you for defending the film and its cast, Vince. Yes, I really think Len always. And the guest hosts have a hard time putting things in the context of when it was made. Mm. We do not. Are there flaws? Yes. Do all films have flaws? Yes. Did The Wiz do the most with what it had? I think so. I don't. Richard Pryor can't sing, but he puts butts in seats. Mm-hmm. Who would more people line up to see at that moment in time? Stephanie Mills or Miss Ross? Mm. Never forget what one of your guests said. Black people do the most, and I would add with the least.
Mm.
Finally, I had to tap out after they cloned Tyrone.
Mm.
I love the script, the acting, and the exploration of quote unquote our conspiracies. That said, the film kind of dragged in a few places and not enough to make me start pondering why did I not sit down for this? A great, great month. Afrofuturism is magical to me, and I appreciate you two tackling it for a month. I do have one question, though.
Mm.
What other months are you planning or kicking around for a pointed exploration? I'd love to see or hear a film, a month of, say, film noir, war films, more horror, October,
yeah.
Or icons such as Denzel or Samuel, Angela Bassett, Richard Pryor, Ruby Dee. All the best, Michael Lockett.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Michael. Well, we are actually about to, after tonight's conclusion of Octavia April, we are about to kick into, I don't know if it's ours, but it certainly seems to be a lot of people's favorite month.
People seem to enjoy.
Which is May, which is short for Mother May I Have Another One of Those Bad Black Movies. We've been doing this now for at least a few years, probably 5 years straight.
Yeah.
Where we dedicate May to films that from the outside looking in.
Right. Sometimes from the inside looking.
They seem that they look like they might be a bad film.
Always coming from inside.
We give them their just due. We'll tell you exactly what we're going to be leading off May with at the end of the show tonight. So looking forward to that because we actually have a special guest that will be joining us for that episode. And of course, in October, we're going to be doing more horror.
Sure. Oftentimes, June, we do music.
June is usually Black Music Month.
You said we were going to have...
Well, September is documentaries.
September for documentaries.
You know, Doc to School.
Yeah.
And then I guess February has usually been Westerns.
We were doing Westerns.
But this year we kind of leaned more into the romantic because we had a Love Jones screening.
Right.
That month. But we usually do Westerns.
Right.
I think that's...
I mean, that's a lot of months.
That's a lot of months. I think maybe... Well, March is Women's History Month.
Right.
So at least one of us tries to do some women.
Some directors, yeah.
Yeah. And then I try and do like some action films in August.
Yeah.
For the summer.
You know, we like to keep it fluid.
I know. I will say this, though. I know that after we get through June, and maybe even sometime I might be able to sneak it in June. I'm overdue to dig back into the crates and get back into like the 30s and 40s.
All right, fair.
You know, pull some movies out of there. Mm-hmm. And we're definitely overdue to return back to the oeuvre of our namesake.
I mean, if we do music in June, we still have not done Cabin in the Sky.
No, we haven't. That's actually, we're streaming this week.
And is that a music? Would that be?
It's a musical.
So there you go.
It is a musical.
We'll probably do Cabin in the Sky in June, and we'll find some other Negro films with an all-colored cast.
It's interesting. He says war films. I'm trying to think of a lot of black war films that we haven't covered. We did Glory.
I have been, what is the joint? There are one or two that I've had written down.
Really?
Yeah.
I was thinking, man,
including Miracle at St. Anna or St. Anna. Yeah, the Spike Lee war film.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Yeah,
I forgot about that one. And I was thinking about Sergeant Rutledge.
Right, which we haven't done for the show.
Haven't done that yet. Yeah. All right. Well, we'll find a couple.
Yeah.
All right. One more email.
Okay.
Pinpointed here. This is from Sean Simmons.
Hey, what's up, Sean?
It's been a minute since we've heard from him.
Yeah.
And he hopes all is well. Two things. First, Len, since Vincent, a lot of people are talking to me directly in these emails.
I know.
First, Len, since Vincent made the executive decision that one of the entrees on your top five Tyrones to clone didn't happen, doesn't exist, I have a replacement to offer. It did happen. I actually texted him the cartoon and he refused to watch it.
I did because I think I thought Lynn was working for the FBI and this was something to try and hypnotize me.
Now, knowing that y'all all were reviewing the Clone Tyrone, a Jamie Foxx film, I was certain Jamie Foxx character named Tyrone from the Jamie Foxx show would be present on the list. Sadly, he didn't make the cut. So here you go, Lynn, a reprieve. Let's get Tyrone Coppell, Jamie's Ted Coppell character on the list for consideration. What do you say? So what do you say about his, I did not watch one episode of the Jamie Foxx.
Wow. Team. I am so glad you said it first so I wouldn't have to. I've never seen one episode of the Jamie Foxx
Me
show.
Me neither. It just did not look like it was.
Yeah, I just.
No.
So I can't speak on it.
No. So I'm sorry.
It may have been the greatest television show to have ever been created. I don't know. I've never seen one episode. Please don't ask me about the Williams brothers. Or Half and Half. Or Sister Sister.
I feel like I would have thought you would have watched at least Half and Half or Sister Sister. I've seen at least a couple of episodes of all of those.
Oh, so you think you're better than me? Is that what this is?
Apparently I am.
Oh, well, I mean, I've seen at least a couple of it. So like you saw an episode and then you said like spin up another one.
I didn't say that.
I mean,
you but know. I've watched it.
Right.
I've been in the room when it was
been
on.
In the room.
Sean continues. Lastly, I've always enjoyed the conversations you two have before the review begins. I like hearing you all talk about a lot of things that I'm into, picking up tidbits and new information here and there, and even learning something new. Mm. For a while now, out of all the things you've discussed, one particular thing has been in the forefront of my mind. The television series, Baby, I'm Back.
Baby, I'm Back, big boy. We didn't have time to get into Baby, I'm Back when our conversation. Sean, stick around. We have something in the hopper that you might enjoy.
He continues.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I turned 40 in a couple of months.
Okay.
So this predates me about 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
I was floored when y'all all discussed the premise, who was in it, everything else.
Mm-hmm.
While having a conversation about a hypothetical streaming service that focuses on short-run series, my friends and I were throwing out names of shows that lasted 1 to 3 years that we wouldn't mind seeing again, and Baby, I'm Back popped right back up on my mind.
Look.
So I did it. I took the dive, and I ran through all of the episodes.
Okay.
They're all old recordings from BET on YouTube now.
Mm-hmm.
All I could say watching those episodes were, wow, and how?
Yes, those are good responses.
And did they really have to run through the story of Raymond Ellis leaving his family for 7 years and popping back up as the theme song?
I was about to say.
Yes, let people, give people the premise.
Baby, I'm Back is just what it sounds like. Damon Wilson plays Raymond. A ne'er-do-well. Is he a gambler?
I think so. I think that's what it is.
Who abandons his family.
Mm-hmm.
His wife, played by the ever wonderful
Denise Nicholas. Yes.
And he has two kids. One little boy whose name, I'm sorry, I don't remember. But his daughter is played by a very young Kim Fields.
Mm-hmm.
He has a mother-in-law who I think is.
I don't remember.
But you know exactly who she is. Old girl. 227.
Marla Gibbs?
No, not Marla Gibbs. The old lady.
Oh, I know who you're talking about. I can't remember her name, but
right.
I know
I'm pretty sure she plays the mother-in-law.
Okay.
And he has abandoned the family. It's been 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
And now he circles back around. Denise Nicholas has gotten her life together. She actually has a fiance.
Of course.
And then the entire premise of the show is Damon Wilson's
Helen Martin.
Mm-hmm. Damon Wilson disrupting her life that she's put back together after he destroyed it.
Yes.
And it's called But Baby, I'm Back.
Baby, I'm Back.
And so much of the plot revolves around Damon Wilson's character and his daughter, Kim Fields, who's a child.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Trying to break up this woman's life.
Mm-hmm.
And this is comedy.
Deshaun continues.
Mm-hmm.
I'll just shake my head at the white folks that made this and shift focus to ask about one of the stars of the show.
Okay.
Denise Nicholas.
Oh, yes. Hey, always.
It has always been a pleasure to see Denise Nicholas pop up.
Mm-hmm.
In reading some background about the show, I learned that she was a hot commodity after coming off of Room 222, a show that I discovered a few years back, and Let's Do It Again, A Piece of the Action, and Capricorn 1. But after this...
Thought she was in Capricorn 1.
And after this, she really doesn't do a whole lot outside of popping in and out of guest roles once or twice a year.
That's
until
true.
She lands on In the Heat of the Night.
That's right.
A decade after Baby, I'm Back. How did she go from someone who was sought after to barely seen? Do you think she got caught up in the mix of other stars rising of the time? As always, thanks for all you do, Sean.
I do. I think that's exactly what it is.
Exactly what happened.
You know, I think it's difficult for actresses generally getting older. And Denise Nicholas is a black actress.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I thought, you know, one of my great kind of glimmers into what could have been. She's actually on an episode of A Different World.
Okay.
Where she and Colonel Taylor are kind of feeling each, you know, around each other, orbiting around each other. But she's funny. And, you know, I love funny Denise Nicholas. Like, you know, I loved her on In the Heat of the Night just because The Heat of the Night was Heat of the Night just got more and more bizarre as the years went on.
Yeah, because she becomes the love interest.
Yeah, they get married,
right?
Yeah,
her and Carol O'Connor.
Yeah, oh yeah, oh yeah. Oh yeah, by the end, the Heat of the Night is just completely off the rails. Like, it's, you know, I don't want to make fun of Howard Rollins and you know, all the challenges he went through. Mm-hmm. But when Howard Rollins was going through his challenges,
yeah,
instead of them saying, well, one half of In the Heat of the Night is now off the board, we should probably pull the plug on the whole thing. They said, nope.
No, well, because Carol Connor was running the show.
He was running the show. And you know, it really does feel bad making jokes because, you know, part of the reason he wanted to keep the show on.
Carol Connor?
Yeah, because his son was struggling.
Yes,
with drugs.
And his son was also.
And he said
that was his one that was, steady.
That piece. Was a steady thing. And that was a way for him to keep an eye on his son.
Right. For those who know, his son was also a co-star on the show.
Right. Right. And well, as we say, Carol O'Connor wanted to keep it going. But then like Carl Weathers.
Yeah.
Shows up for a couple of seasons. And remember, Bubba was racist.
Mm-hmm.
But then I guess he connected with the viewer. So then they made Bubba like almost a co-lead, and he wasn't as racist.
It was a weird show. I didn't watch that much of it. I watched enough to be like, ooh, this.
I watched Not surprising if you know me. A surprising amount of In the Heat of the Night. Like, I watched a lot of In the Heat of the Night.
Why?
Because it was so bizarre. It was so bizarre. I remember the ad. I remember the ad campaign where Carl Weathers came on the show, and he said, there's some new heat in the town. And he had on, like, a real tight uniform.
Of course he did.
I said, boy, In the Heat of the Night is completely bonkers.
Of course he did.
Yeah.
Of course he did. Carl Weathers wore everything like it was skin. You know that. You know that.
But have you ever seen the credits for the show he had? What was the television show he had?
I don't remember.
No. The credits are the most homoerotic thing you've ever seen in your entire life. Because the credits are just close-ups of Carl Weathers with no shirt on, itty-bitty pants. What is the name of Carl Weathers' show? He had a television show.
What, it was a syndicated show?
It was on like ABC for a year.
Really? Was it the Carl Weathers show?
Oh, no. I was hoping somebody would put it up.
I'm looking it up. I'm looking it up. I'm looking it up.
Because when you say the name, I'll remember it.
I'm looking it up. Street Justice?
Was it Street Justice?
I'm looking at it. This was in 1990 to 93. I'm looking at Carl Weathers' TV show.
I feel like it was before then.
Oh, Fortune Dane.
That's it. That's it.
I've never heard of this joke.
That is it.
I've never. Fortune Dane.
Fortune Dane.
A tough detective relinquishes Fortune his badge Dane. To track down a hitman.
I do not say this loosely. I do not say this as euphemism. I do not say this as insult. The credits for this show are the gayest thing you've ever seen in your life.
Oh my God. Listen to the name of these leads. Carl Weathers plays Fortune Dane.
Fortune Dane. He like plays a horn. Like, I think he plays a saxophone.
And his co-lead, Daphne Ashbrook, plays Speed Davenport.
We just talked about it last week. These creators have never actually met a black person.
There's only 6 episodes.
Yeah.
Oh, we have to watch this.
Oh.
We've got to do a binge lounge about Fortune Dane.
Yeah. It's like somebody said, you know what? Let's make Hawk, a man called Hawk, but not as good and not as threatening.
Fortune Dane. Oh, my God.
And someone go get some more baby oil for Carl Weathers.
Oh, my God.
Mm-hmm. That's it.
I can't. Mm-hmm. I can't.
Absolutely. It's fantastic.
I can't. Oh, my God. Mm-hmm. I have to make this
happen. Don't watch your credits because you'll get pulled in. It's too much while we're on right now. Because you'll want to watch it right now. Little, you'll stop the show.
All right, let's get back to Denise Nicholas.
All right, Denise Nicholas, yes, sir.
Because I'm wondering what happened, because Sean does make a good point, because mm-hmm. I remember the show Room 222 back in mm-hmm. the early 70s.
Yes, it was very earnest.
It was a very earnest show.
Very earnest.
You know, it was like almost like a dramedy. It was
upstanding
for the time.
Negroes.
Look, man, it wasn't. Do you remember? Even really, really remember the show?
You forget, we talked about this. I own the box set.
Okay, but that doesn't mean you really remember it. Have you watched it?
Yeah, I've watched it. Okay. It's very earnest.
Well, it was of its time.
Yes.
Like I said, it was a dramedy before dramedies were a thing.
Right.
But Denise Nicholas was kind of nice on there.
Yeah.
But then she does make her way, as he points out, mm-hmm. to movies.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, not that she was like a big lead in any of these movies.
No, not at
but
all.
But she definitely, especially in like the black films, had a substantial role.
She was a working actress all throughout the 70s.
I wonder if she at that point kind of like, because this was in the days where you kind of like tried to toe that line,
mm-hmm.
whether or not you were going to go all in on movies or whether you're going to be on television.
Sure.
Television, the pickings were few and slim,
mm-hmm.
especially for black actresses.
Right.
And in the movies, maybe she thought she could get more varied roles.
Mm-hmm.
She was already making movies, part of like relatively hit films.
I mean, I forgot she was in Capricorn 1. Like, that's quite a leap.
Well, it is. You know, she doesn't have a big role in it, but
yeah, but someone out of blaxploitation in a big studio film like Capricorn One.
I wonder if that does play a part in kind of like curtailing or stifling her career a little bit, because she, I think that, you know, of all the black actresses of that time, and it's more than a few.
Yeah,
you know, Pam Grier and Tamara Dobson, they kind of like found their lane. They made whatever they could of it, right? But there are people like Denise Nicholas and Rosalind Cash,
yeah,
you know, who kind of had to feel their way around. You know what I mean? And with all due respect to Rosalind Cash, Denise Nicholas, I think, had the chops and had kind of like more, maybe more of the, you know, mainstream look that I would have thought that she would have gotten more pop.
I think the 80s were tough.
But we're not talking the 80s. We're talking about mid-70s.
No. I think, because, you know,
we're talking mid to late 70s.
Look, a piece of the action is, I think, 77. And it, like, I think she bounced around until 1980 or so. I mean, what year is Capricorn One? Like, I think she did all right through the 70s.
No, Capricorn One is like, it's still 70s.
Right. Like, I really do think 1980 is when we're talking to, like, we're really talking about the 80s.
Yeah. And by then she, well, like, you're right. By then she's probably in her 30s. And
she's in her 30s. And again, where are you working?
Yeah. Yeah. That's a shame, though.
Yeah. It's,
but, well, you know what? But that's what made it, say what we will about In the Heat of the Night, that's what made it more all the more rewarding that she did land there.
Yes.
Was on there for more than a few seasons. Look, you know, and on, this is back when network television, you were making good money.
Oh yeah.
When you were, you know, yeah, on a series. So God bless her.
Look, I love, you know, I love me some Nicholas.
Oh yeah, man.
So
all right.
All right.
All right. That is our emails, ladies and gentlemen. Right. If you have an email that you want to send our way, you can feel free to email us at michaumission@gmail.com. That is michaumission@gmail.com. Another thing that you can do, ladies and gentlemen, if you really are really, like, you know, real fans of ours, you know, really appreciate it, like this type of stuff, you can give us a 5-star rating and a review, especially if it is on Apple Podcasts, because that goes a long way to helping people find our show. The better we do in the algorithms of Apple, the more that they kind of promote the show to like-minded people that are into films and into black films and might like our little show, such as Traveling Jason on 425 of this year gave us a 5-star review. One of the best pods around.
Thank you, Jason.
The highlight of my week is when Len and Vincent release a new episode. I listen to a multitude of podcasts, but this is the only one where I listen to every episode that's released. Their perspective is so fresh, nuanced, and fun. You're unlikely to find it elsewhere.
Oh, thank you so much. We appreciate that.
I really do appreciate that, Jason. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. All right.
All right.
And it's time for us to continue on.
Moving on.
This merry journey of ours.
Yes.
As we take a look at the top five.
Top five. Who's your top five?
Top five, ladies and gentlemen, where I come up with a list and I give Vincent said list and he gives me and you his scintillating commentary on it. And tonight's top five, Vincent, in keeping in theme with Octavia April.
Very nice.
A few weeks ago, we did a top five looking at some top five Afrofuturistic novels that have yet to be adapted in any way into television or into film.
Yeah.
That were just sitting there ripe for the plucking. And today, this is going to be in your wheelhouse. I picked from the 21st century five Afrofuturistic comic books.
Oh yeah, I know two or three that better be on here
that you may want to add to your summer read.
Absolutely.
All right. Now, I purposefully, as much as I could, stayed away from the big comic book producer, DC and Marvel.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I tried to veer closer to the realm of fantasy if I could.
Okay.
All right. But and some of these are comic books that have gotten some acclaim and have been mentioned before here on the show.
Mm-hmm.
But doesn't mean that we can't count them out again.
You always like to shine a light.
Most definitely.
What we got?
So number five. From Black Mask Studios.
Mm-hmm.
The product of Kwanze Osejiofo.
Mm-hmm.
Never say the man's name. He's been on my Black Tribbles about three times.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, Kwanze. Tim Smith III, as well as Jamal Igel. Black.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Black is a comic book that proposes the idea, what if the black people were the ones that had superpowers?
Yeah.
Developed superpowers.
Yeah.
This was a comic book that hit the world hard when it came out.
It really did. More than a few years ago. Yeah.
And it's now spawned like a universe of mm-hmm. like sequels
mm-hmm.
and subtitles from it. But it is a very striking book. I love speculative fiction
mm-hmm.
in this way.
Yeah.
It is almost like a Black Mirror episode come to life.
Yeah.
And the artwork by Jamal Igel. I love Jamal Igel, one of my favorite artists.
Yeah.
And I know you were a huge fan of Black when it came out.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And then, you know, it was very much something reflective of that moment
mm-hmm.
when it came out. I always think about that in conjunction with the Luke Cage television show and that very evocative image of Luke Cage's hoodie.
Yeah.
Bullet holes in it. But it didn't break his skin.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Black, it's good stuff.
Yeah. And like the prevailing image of Black,
right.
the first comic book was a black boy in a hoodie with his hands up.
I have to say, as someone who is happy for all of the makers of Black, I'm so happy for them that things have gone well and you know, it almost immediately went into development mm-hmm. with various projects. But as someone who liked the series, and this happens sometimes when a series gets a certain level of acclaim, the creators get so busy.
They're not able to.
They're not able to produce more of the comic itself.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, but yeah, what we have, absolutely enjoy it.
Most definitely.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So number four from Image Comics
mm-hmm.
from Brandon Thomas and Carrie Randolph.
Mm-hmm.
Excellence.
Yeah.
Spencer Dales was born into the world of magic.
Mm-hmm.
His father belongs to the Aegis, a secret society of black magicians ordered by their unseen masters to better the lives of others of higher potential, but never themselves.
Yeah.
And now it's time for Spencer to follow in his father's footsteps. All he sees is a broken system in need of someone with the wand and the will to change it. But in this fight for a better future, who will stand beside him? Carrie Randolph and Brandon Thomas ignite this generational war in an action fantasy series made entirely by creators of color and committed to one truth above all others. Excellence is real.
Yeah. Yeah. Excellence is one of my favorite series of the past 10 years. And I have to say, I was so amazingly disappointed with what happened with, what was the name of the movie that came out and went away? And it's so funny, we were talking about things like this before the show started, that we've all kind of collectively decided we're never going to discuss again. The Magical Negro movie that was just out.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that literally came and went.
Like, I'm so angry that, frankly, we kind of blew our chance with the Black Magician series with that movie. Because Excellence, and I think I said this on air, like, Excellence is sitting right there.
Yeah, but do you think I don't think we really blew our chance with that.
I mean, I hope we did.
No.
But, you know, I know how this kind of works with execs and people who kind of make decisions. Oh, well, y'all said you want some black magic, black magicians. We gave you some black magicians. And y'all didn't come and see it.
Now, if anything, And I don't think we, I
hope you're right.
I don't think that blew our chance.
Okay.
If anything did blow the chance and maybe push the idea of adapting excellence down the road a little bit, it may be the one and done of Lovecraft Country.
Well, maybe.
Because that involved magic.
Well, yeah, but it wasn't like Lovecraft Country is like excellence is actually about
magic.
Magicians. Like, right. and excellence Lovecraft is damn near the Black Hogwarts that everyone said they thought they were going to get with this movie. And then they didn't.
Well, did they really? I didn't think that was really the premise of the movie.
No, it wasn't. But I mean, people are like, ooh, it's black people with wands and, and excellence is 100% that.
Mm.
And it's so well thought out.
See, here's the thing. I think excellence, because I love the book too.
Mm-hmm.
I think excellence is perfect for adaptation for television.
I think you're right.
I think it's
I hope you're
right. It's perfect for adaptation for streaming so that you don't have to have any compromising of the subject matter. Not that it goes over
and
the top.
And you can tell, like I said, they've thought this thing out.
Yeah, the world building.
Like you can tell they got 5 years in them.
And I love beautiful world building, but I love that when the world building is just there. Because sometimes stories they build it up so much they want to show you the world and they forget to really just develop the story.
You're right.
Excellence does both, you know, and that's the Brandon Thomas, a beautiful writer.
Excellence is absolutely.
What I would love, and I don't see, I wonder whether or not it would happen, is if there was. Excellence, I can see definitely being produced by black creators as far as the television series. But I would love for it to be on a black streaming service. And that's the thing.
Unless one is developed in the next 5 years with the type of financial backing.
Because it's going to need money.
Because you need money.
Yeah.
To do excellence right.
To do it right.
Yeah.
To do it right.
Like, I would love to be in a room at Apple TV. And tell them, put some silo money, put some severance money,
put some foundation money,
put some foundation money. Excellence.
Yeah, because foundation looks great, but it's low.
I love excellence. Love excellence.
All right, number three. This is from Fantagraphics.
Okay.
This is from Ezra Clayton Daniels and Ben Passmore.
Okay, yeah.
Bottom Feeders.
Yeah.
Afrofuturist horror comedy about gentrification, hip-hop, and cultural appropriation.
Yep.
Once a thriving working-class neighborhood on Chicago's South Side, the Bottom Yards is now the definition of urban blight. When an aspiring fashion designer named Darla and her image-obsessed friend Cynthia descend upon the neighborhood in search of cheap rent, they soon discover something far more seductive and sinister lurking behind the walls of their new home.
Mm-hmm.
Like a cross between Jordan Peele's Get Out and John Carpenter's The Thing, Daniels and Passmore's Bottom Feeders offers a vision of horror that is gross and gory in all the right ways. Yet, at turns, it's funny, scary, and thought-provoking. And it's very disarming because the art is like, you know, very cartoony.
Mm-hmm.
But the story goes deep.
I have to say, I'm surprised you like Bottom Feeders. Because you don't really like horror comics.
I don't really like horror comics. Yeah. And as cartoony as it is, sometimes that makes the horror even a little bit more hard.
Yeah, I think Bottom Fuse is actually disturbing.
It is. It's a little disturbing. That's what I'm saying. It's disarming.
Yeah.
Because it's cartoony, and then you'll turn the page and you're like,
Ooh. It's really good.
It's really, really good.
Yeah, but it is.
It took me a minute to finish it.
Like I said in my head, I said, I think I'm going to go home and reread Excellence. I am not rereading.
No.
Yeah, Bottom Feeders is not something you just jump into.
Oh, dog. I would not lie.
Yeah.
You see where I'm sitting in this chair?
Yeah, I know.
Where I read Bottom Feeders, it was there. Because I would be like.
Ben Passmore had a comic called Your Black Friend.
Yes.
Which was amazing. Mm-hmm. So I really like him as a creator. Bottom Feeders, which is a graphic novel as mm-hmm. opposed to a series
yeah.
like the other two, is very good. But
very
yeah.
good.
All right. Yeah, yeah. I'd like to see that.
All right.
All right.
Number two.
Number two.
This is a comic book series that, like Black, I believe has been optioned.
Okay.
To be turned into something. And boy, if they can make it work, it'll be fantastic. Mm-hmm. From Image Comics. I know mm-hmm. this is the favorite of Vincent's as well.
Mm-hmm.
From Sanford Green, Chuck Brown, and David F. Walker.
Yes, sir.
Bitter Root. In the 1920s, the Harlem Renaissance is in full swing, and only the I always want to pronounce the name wrong. It's Sanjuray.
Yeah, Sanjuray. Mm-hmm.
Sanjuray family can save New York and the world from the supernatural forces threatening to destroy humanity. But the once great family of monster hunters has been torn apart by tragedies and conflicting moral codes. In this comic book that combines elements of early 20th century African American culture,
mm-hmm.
voodoo, mm-hmm. as well as film noir.
Mm-hmm.
They chose the creators chose that era because they felt it embodied both incredible artistic and cultural growth, as well as institutionalized racism, which provided opportunities for conflict. And yes, this has been optioned for a film adaptation mm-hmm. by Legendary Pictures. Bitter Root, which is, I think, is in their third collection of issues. I know I have at least the first three.
Mm-hmm.
A great, great comic book.
Love that damn Bitter Root.
It is one of my favorite comic books of the last goodness. Few years.
Sanford Green is one of my favorite new artists.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I love his art. I love the story. I love the premise. And then, you know, with, you know, my nerdy self, I love at the end of every issue, they have like an essay.
Yeah.
Like they get somebody to, you know, and oh my God, I love Bitter.
Yeah. And we were talking about,
so good.
We were talking earlier, like a couple of weeks ago, I think, or maybe even last week
mm-hmm.
about Black films that are maybe like period pieces set in around mm-hmm. this time. Can you imagine?
Oh,
like
man.
Now this while not being magic, but this to me is like just would be a, like almost have like a Harry Potter type of feel.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like old English, old world.
Right. But just set during the Harlem Renaissance.
Harlem Renaissance?
Oh, yeah. Oh, come on, stop. Yeah, Bitter Root is, yeah. Bitter Root is perfect.
Oh, my God.
Bitter Root is, yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
But. I have the one, if there was one comic book that Vincent would love to see adapted before Bitter Root, it is definitely number one,
mm-hmm.
I believe.
Right. Lynn just was listening to me and listening stuff. So go ahead.
This is also from Image Comics.
Yes, it is.
And it's by
Rodney Barnes
and Jason Scott Alexander.
There it is.
It is Philadelphia.
You're going to try to describe Philadelphia and you're not going to describe all of it.
Well, let's see.
Okay.
When a small town beat cop comes home to mm-hmm. bury his murdered father,
mm-hmm.
revered Philadelphia detective James Sangster Sr., he stumbles into a mystery that will lead him down a path of horrors and shakes his beliefs to the core.
Mm-hmm.
The city that was once the symbol of liberty and freedom has fallen prey to corruption, poverty, unemployment, brutality, And vampires.
That's right.
Now it's up to Jimmy and an unexpected companion to stop long thought dead president of the United States, John Adams.
Right, because John Adams is involved.
From building an undead army.
Because John Adams is a vampire.
A bloody new American revolution.
Mm-hmm.
There's a reason why they say you can't go home again. Welcome to Philadelphia.
Man, Rodney friggin' Barnes. This is the only comic book that I read every month, and I have absolutely no idea what I'm getting myself into.
Mm.
Like, I can never tell which direction he's going, and this is 100% a compliment. Oh, yeah, this is, because we haven't even mentioned Blackula showing up.
You He's having all the fun. He's pulling out all the stops.
Philadelphia is fantastic. It is bananas.
Yeah, yeah.
But in the best way.
See, and it's horror. So
because it's scary.
It scares me.
Yeah, it's look, it's a scary comic. It's scary.
It straight up scares me.
Let's be clear. I read in the daytime.
See?
Because it is scary.
That's why you might do. Yeah. There are some comic books. I'll be at night. I'm like, no, I'll read this one in the morning.
There's a graphic novel called, it's like Stranger Fiction or Science Fiction, about a dude who gets abducted by aliens. Mm-hmm. And then the whole graphic novel is about him trying to convince people that he got abducted. Like, they don't show the abduction. They don't tell you whether or not it really happened. The whole thing is about him. Yeah, I don't even mess with that. Like, I read it once and I said, yeah, this is fantastic, but I'm not messing with this no more.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and somebody said it too, and Rodney Barnes, and we talk about this on here, actually did a Blackula graphic novel that was ridiculously good.
I've been, peek behind the curtain, ladies and gentlemen, I've been trying to get Rodney on the show.
Yeah.
I've been trying. So look, missionaries, you gotta end.
Yeah, missionaries.
George Kimono, I know you know all the comic book guys. Right. Like, yo.
Because I follow him on social media, and he's always talking about movies.
I'm that's why I've been trying to get him.
Like, dog.
He won't answer.
Right. All right. But yeah, these are all very good choices.
Yes, these would be very good choices for your summer reading pleasure, ladies and gentlemen. If you are into comics, and even if you're not into comics, because trust me, these are not the comics that you grew up on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and these are not the comics that leave around the house for the kids.
Yeah.
No. So no, Dylan, you can't read Philadelphia. Sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry, your mama ain't going to come beat my ass. All right. All right, ladies and gentlemen.
All right.
That was the top five. It is now time for the Game of Kings.
Right. The real black graphic novel.
That would be 6 Degrees of D'Urville Martin.
Right.
Six Degrees of D'Urville Martin, ladies and gentlemen, where Vincent has 6 actors or less to connect the actors that I give him.
Okay.
To that walking Blackula himself.
Mm-hmm.
D'Urville Martin of D'Urville 70s Martin. Movies fame.
Right. Who was not in Blackula or Scream. Blackula, Scream. We could connect him very quickly. Both
films. Oh, it certainly could. Certainly could. Mm-hmm. Keep it in theme, Vincent.
Okay, theme.
These are 2 actors who appear in the film that we are going to be reviewing tonight.
Okay.
The Marvels.
All right.
So.
Who we got?
Because of that,
mm-hmm.
You cannot use either the Marvels.
Okay.
Or any Marvel movie.
Fair.
To connect them to D'Urville Martin.
That is fair.
Okay. All right.
Who we got? That I cannot use anything in the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
That's correct.
All right.
So starting with number 1, we have Brie Larson.
The star herself.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. See, this is where you messed up. You messed up because you and I have actually been together and watched a movie she was in.
Really? Which one was that?
Well, because, let's see, how am I going to get here?
I know which one I'm thinking of. I don't know which one you're thinking of.
Okay. All right, let's start the usual way. So D'Urville Martin is in 5 on the Black Hand side with Dick Anthony Williams. Dick Anthony Williams is in Mo Better Blues, but he's in Mo Better Blues with Robin Harris.
Yes.
Robin Harris is in House Party with A.J. Johnson.
Okay.
A.J. Johnson is in Baby Boy with Tyrese.
Yes.
And Tyrese is in Fast 10 with Brie Lawson.
Very good.
Because she plays Special Agent, that's Special right. Agenton.
That's right.
And me, you, and I sat between you and my wife, and I cackled like Robert Mitchum in Cape Fear. Because you know I love dumb, dumbass Fast and the Furious movies.
You do.
Oh, how I cackled for 2 hours in that movie. And then Brie Lawson showed up as Special Agenton.
I forgot she was in that
movie. Ving Rhames, you can't do this. And Ving Rhames said, I can do whatever I need to do because family.
It wasn't Ving Rhames.
Not Ving Rhames, Vin Diesel.
Vin Diesel.
Because family. And then he proceeded to break the laws of physics.
Oh, God.
Oh, how I love those Fast and Furious. Is that the only one she's in? Because the other thing about Fast and Furious and this one, like, people, remember, people will pop up and they, like, do this reveal. Like, oh, it's the character from Too Fast, Too Furious, Tokyo Drift. Yeah. As if someone remembers.
Yeah.
Who's in, like.
Yeah, because they were in the background.
Right.
And I think that's the only one that I see.
That's the only. So she wasn't, like, Special Agent, Special Agington in, like, Fast Five?
No. No, I knew she wasn't in Fast Five. Because Fast Five, the big thing is The Rock.
Right. She knew with the fast knowledge. Because remember, I cackled and I said all through the movie, I bet The Rock's going to show up because Black Adam didn't do that well.
Oh, yeah. You know, The Rock.
And then they had the credits and then they did the reveal.
And it was The Rock.
And it was The Rock. It was like, oh, we're all so surprised that The Rock showed up.
Mm-hmm.
Even after he said he wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
But then Black Adam didn't do well.
And he said, yo, we need to do an extra scene on that. Say right here in that contract, I can come back within 6 months.
Oh, boy. And I can't lose in the fight. And I have to have the equal amount of punches as the other guy. You know that's in his contracts.
That was in his contract with Vin Diesel. I don't think that was
in that was also in his contract in Hobbs and Shaw.
Was it really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And if you look at the movie, he doesn't lose fights.
Well, right.
There's also a certain amount of punches that he takes and throws.
So what did he do? Just adapt William Shatner's script? Contract.
Oh, did Shatner do that too?
Oh, you don't know about that?
I did not know that. I thought this was some prima donna new actor stuff.
Dog. William Shatner is famous because, you know, like the big thing about him in the series, you know, was, and then it kind of like carried over a little bit into the movies, is that he would go through the scripts.
Right, he'd count the lines.
No. Yes, he would count the lines. Yeah. He would count the lines between him and Leonard Nimoy, make sure that they added up. But in the series, and then especially in like the first movie, he was taking lines that were given to the other characters and said, well, I'm sitting there on the bridge. The captain should be saying this line. So he would assign the lines to him, have them rewritten for him.
Mm-hmm.
So he was taking lines from them. And Leonard Nimoy was like, oh, no, you won't. And that's when the whole counting came down between those two.
Right. But I didn't know he had to win fights. Because he famously was upset about the way his character, spoiler, died in Generations.
To be fair, I think he had a right to be upset because it was a weak way for him to die.
If he hadn't been a dick for 30 years, maybe
that's true.
Like, you know.
That's true. But no, I don't. There wasn't a stipulation in regards to the fight.
Okay.
But I'm just saying, is it along those same lines?
Got you.
The movie, I thought, we didn't see it together, but I thought you might have been referencing, because I actually forgot about Fast 10, was Kong Skull Island, because she was in that. She's the female in love interest, I guess, more or less, in Kong Skull Island.
She goes to Skull Island with Samuel Jackson and them?
No, Samuel Jackson. They are there. She goes to Skull Island with Loki.
I 100% forgot about that.
Yeah, she goes to Skull Island with Loki and John Goodman.
Yeah. Oh, I forgot all about that.
Yeah.
But I remember her in Fast 10 because
by the time, Agent,
Fast 10 was like the love boat by the end. Like, why is Gal Gadot in this? It's like people just kept popping up.
I know. Yeah, because she shows back.
Right.
She comes back.
Right. It's like.
Well, because we never saw the body. She just fell off the plane.
Also, Wonder Woman 2 didn't do as well as they thought it was going to. It was a bunch of people. But you know, the Fast and Furious.
There's a bunch of people knocking on the door.
But the Fast and Furious series, like, that's a tradition of Fast and Furious. Like, you know, Vin Diesel didn't come back for Too Fast, Too Furious because he thought he was too big for his britches.
He thought Riddick.
Right, right. And then Riddick didn't do that well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Then family.
All right.
All right.
The next actor who appears in this film.
Oh, boy.
You have 6 films or less to connect Derville Martin to Kelsey Grammer.
Oh, right, right, because he's in the end. Right.
Can't use any Marvel movies. And before you ask, he has been more than a few films besides the Marvel movie.
Bad thing is I was just about to fix my mouth and be cute and do Star Trek. But that was on television. Well, he was on Next Generation.
Yes.
He wasn't in the movies. Oh, okay. Because I'm thinking about John Goodman
mm-hmm.
as the evil teddy bear. But I'm thinking about that. I think that's Toy Story 3. But Kelsey Grammer is in Toy Story 2. Right?
You tell me.
Right. Kelsey Grammer's in Toy Story 2. Right. So, okay. So there you go. So he's in Toy Story 2 with Tom Hanks. And then Tom Hanks is in Philadelphia with Denzel Washington, mm-hmm. who is in Mo Better Blues with Dick Anthony Williams, who's in 5 on the Black Hand Side with Derville Martin.
Very good.
Right, right. Because he plays like the hootin' tootin'.
Stinky Pete.
Because it's weird. Because he's, you know, he's Kelsey Grammer. So you expect him to play like a dude drinking tea.
Yeah, but he can act.
But he's actually an actor.
He's actually an actor. I didn't expect that. I was fine with him doing the voice of Stinky Pete.
With him playing against type. I guess, is he in the Simpsons movie?
Yes.
I don't know if I could, I probably could get from the Simpsons movie.
Well, you know who he is in the Simpsons universe.
I know he's Krusty the Clown. Not Krusty the Clown. Krusty.
Sideshow Bob.
Is Hank Azaria in as Hank Azaria?
Oh. My movie. Well, he's in my movie.
What's your movie?
The bird. The Robin Williams movie.
Oh, Birdcage.
Birdcage.
Okay, and then I could bounce from him to Robin Williams and go. Okay, all right.
Yeah.
All right, there you go.
Yeah.
But luckily I can do Toy Story 2.
You can.
Yeah. Man,
very good. Very good, Vincent.
Ooh, I didn't know who you was gonna pull. Because that's quite a cast.
It is quite a cast.
I didn't know who you was going to turn, because I knew you weren't going to use any of the blacks.
Well, there's only about 4.
Yeah, but that's a fair number.
Yeah, well, there's only 2 you would have known. Well, 3. I guess 3 you would have known. And they would have been too easy.
Okay.
All right. All 3 of them would have been way too easy. Right,
so was it Tion Paris, Samuel Jackson?
Lashana Lynch.
I know my Lashana Lynch.
Yeah, you know.
Mm-hmm. All right. I love the special effects of this film that the costumers keep trying to hide all them thighs.
And fail.
Like you can tell the cameraman is doing his best not to have Tiana Parrish just be in her full Tiana Parrishness, and he fails miserably the entire film. And then Lashana Lynch is in one shot, and it's like, I don't know if this is the effect that they were going for, but I'll take it.
Amen. All right, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes, we should talk about it.
Why don't we?
Okay.
Why don't we talk about it?
All right.
Let's get into our review of The Marvels.
We'll be back with the film review as soon as we do something funky and have steps in it. Let's go. Come on.
Carol Danvers, prodigal child of the Milky Way.
Nick Fury.
My favorite one-eyed man of intrigue.
How goes it out there?
You know, cold, no air, space.
Captain Marvel. The Annihilator. You took everything from me. And now I'm returning the favor.
Our light-based powers,
so we switch places whenever we use them.
Strong theory.
You can absorb light.
I can see it.
And Kamala.
Who's Kamala?
Hi.
She can turn light into physical matter, which I have never heard of.
I could totally show you.
No!
Targeting every planet we call home. I would never choose to bring anybody into this.
You are not the only thing standing between this and the universe.
Oh my God, we're a team.
Higher.
Further. Faster.
The Marvels from 2023. Once again, Carol Danvers gets her powers entangled with those of both Kamala Khan and Monica Rambeau and forces them to work together to save the universe. The Marvels is part of phase two of the ever-growing Marvel Cinematic Universe, directed by Nia DaCosta, written by Nia DaCosta, as well as, I'm so busy talking, I didn't lost my notes. Nia DaCosta and a series of other writers. It stars Brie Lawson as Carol Danvers, Zawe Aston as Darbeen, Iman Filani as Ms. Marvel, and Tiana Paris as Monica Rambeau. The Marvels was the choice of Lynn Webb. What do you have to say about this film, Mr. Webb?
The Marvels, or as I like to call it, ladies and gentlemen, issue 33 of the Marvel comic book movie universe.
Yes.
The issue where you buy it and you realize, oh, it's been a long time since I read issue 32.
Right.
So yeah. I may need to catch up.
Yeah.
On what's going on. Where is issue 32? Right. I can't remember where.
Or a previously box.
You need a well, I don't think there's a previously box big enough.
Yeah.
For 33 issues.
Yeah.
Of a comic book series. But no, so the Marvels is the movie, like Vincent mentioned, that is the team up of three of the leading women superheroes in the Marvel universe. Captain Marvel, the premier superheroine in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, portrayed by Brie Larson. This is essentially a sequel to the 2019 Captain Marvel movie, which went on to be a huge box office hit when it came out. It was Marvel's first movie that was led by a woman in the lead, and this time they double down by dipping into their Disney Plus series to tap Tiana Paris as the character of Monica Rambeau, last seen in WandaVision, when she kind of like gained her powers. that character gained her powers, and she teams with Kamala Khan, aka Ms. Marvel, from the Ms. Marvel TV series, played by Iman Vellani. And that Disney Plus TV series was just, I think, on just like last year.
Yeah, yeah. Like, it actually rolls right into the
this
movie.
This kind of like, and this, yeah, and this, this movie, which is really a technically a sequel to Captain Marvel, really acts as a sequel to the Ms. Marvel TV series.
Yeah.
Because, like, basically that whole cast, which is her family, is like lifted up whole cloth and put into into this series. And in so much that the series opens up with Ms. Marvel in her room, thinking about her favorite hero, who is Captain Marvel. Mm-hmm. She is Marvel modeled herself after. And you see a lot of animation in that opening scene, which was lifted more or less directly from the TV series.
Yeah. The whole sense of, the whole vibe. Yeah.
Right. That whole vibe is from that TV series. So it was like welcoming you into this world. And the conceit of the story is that these three heroes who have kind of similar powers, they're kind of light based, and meaning that, you know, their hands all glow. When they use their powers for some plot driven reason, they switch places with one another, and then they have to figure out exactly what is happening, and then find out that, that there is actually a big bad villain that is the person that is causing this shift in their powers, because of that villain being Zowie. No, that's not Zowie Ashton. Excuse me.
No, it is.
Is it Zowie Ashton? Yeah. Zowie Ashton as the big Kree villain who wants to return the Kree people to prominence,
right?
And resurrect their home planet.
Right. And the Kree were the villains.
The villains of the Captain Marvel.
The Captain Marvel movie. So now that's the link to the Captain Marvel movie.
Right.
Right.
Right. And then and the Kree have an ongoing war with the Skrulls.
Right, right. One little detail about she's a big bad because of something that happened in the Captain Marvel movie, but the Captain Marvel movie happened 20 years
in the past.
In the past.
Right.
So the Captain Marvel movie is actually set before all of the movies in the Marvel Cinematic movie. And now this one is in current time, in case things aren't convoluted enough yet.
Yes.
Yeah.
And Vincent is explaining this all to you, ladies and gentlemen, so that you are on the same page as you and I.
Mm-hmm.
And also because if you watch the movie, you won't be on that page. Mm-hmm. Because almost none of that is explained in the movie. You are dropped whole cloth, like I said, into issue 33 of this ongoing series. And there is no previously on or previously in the Marvel Universe box. There are some little like word salads in the script that pay homage to things that may have happened before. But it's really, this film just asks you to catch up and trust us. Let us take you by the hand. We're just going to show you a good time. We're just going to show you this adventure that happens in between the huge adventure. Because we all know that, we all know the DNA of these Marvel Cinematic movies now. These are all of these movies are pretty much like little moments in time in between the great big team up that you know eventually is going to come to fight the great big bad that will be introduced in incrementally in all of these films. This film has the challenge of trying to be all-encompassing, just a all-in-one story, even though it's taking little bits of this TV series, this movie from way back, characters that happen in this series, because I mentioned the Skrulls, who their story kind of like plays out in the Secret Invasion, Disney Plus story.
Yeah.
That if you didn't really watch that, you may not know what's going on.
Yeah.
You've got Samuel Jackson's Nick Fury, who's the connective tissue with all of these series. He is no longer of S.H.I.E.L.D. He is now of Saber.
Right. He lives in space.
He lives in space.
Yeah.
And if you haven't been following any of those movies, that's where he is.
Yeah,
he's basically still Nick Fury. He's just walking around. He does a lot of walking in this movie.
Samuel Jackson said, I am 70 years old.
I am 70 years old. This is my 15th film.
Mm-hmm.
Look, where do you need me?
Yeah.
So all of that is put together to make this movie. We've seen this plot before. The heroes, they're switching places. Oh my God, why are we switching places? They figure out why we're switching places. This big bad's got something to do with it. Well, we've got to stop this big bad. Fight the big bad. We lose. Fight them again. We lost, but I think I know the secret to how to beat them. Fight the big bad a third time. Win, but there's a huge sacrifice, of course. And then that leads us to the jump scene at the end. Rinse, wash, repeat. That's your Marvel movie.
Yes. Right?
So you know what you're going to get when you go into this. So what is going to make this different? There are a couple of things that makes this different. One, this is a film that is going to be led by all women: Brie Larson, Tiana Paris, Imani Vellani,
mm-hmm.
Captain Marvel, Ms. Marvel, and Monica Rambeau. This movie is also, as Vincent mentioned, is going to be written and directed by Nia DaCosta.
Yes, sir.
And this is Nia DaCosta, who is coming off of doing great work in the crime noir that we love, Little
mm-hmm.
Woods, and actually being proving herself to be a little bit of a striking auteur of noirish type horror in Candyman.
Yes, sir.
Before she tries her hand at doing a Marvel movie.
Right.
So right there, you've got the ingredients for something a little bit different, something maybe that's a little, you know, that is kind of like what you've seen before, but maybe has the elements to be something different.
Right.
And I think in trying to do something different, this movie is fun. It's a fun film.
Okay.
I could go deep into the story, but one, I really didn't make much sense of it. And because it is pulling from so many different places,
mm-hmm.
I found myself not caring about anything that was going on. Like, you're asked, like, the Skrulls, their world is being threatened by the Kree. You're asked to really care about the Skrulls.
Mm-hmm.
If you didn't watch Secret Invasion,
right.
You don't really care about these Skrulls. And they're introduced within 5 minutes, and then within 5 minutes later, they're gone from the movie.
Yes.
So you never really have much time to be truly invested in them.
Right.
None of them ever becomes a character. They visit another planet, Atlanta. It's kind of like 96% water, and everybody speaks in musical. It's one thing I've learned over recent months, ladies and gentlemen, is that life is a musical. Nothing has ever been more true than watching everybody just break off into musicals in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Fun, quirky.
Sure.
I don't know if it never necessarily sticks to landing.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I didn't care about the people.
Sure.
You just didn't care. But it's something quirky. They're having fun. These are just a movie about people having fun.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I could get along with that. We've talked about Tiana Paris. We just watched her last week in They Clone Tyrone.
Absolutely.
We've seen her more than a few times here on the mission.
Mm-hmm.
She is a favorite actor of ours.
Mm-hmm.
Love Tiana Paris. I watched a couple of episodes of Ms. Marvel
mm-hmm.
on Disney Plus. It is a show. I think this is another problem. It is a show that was a not a bad show. It
yeah,
was good.
I actually like Ms. Marvel. Yeah.
And I like what I saw too. The only reason I didn't stick with it is because it was a show that I could tell was not made for my demographic.
That is 100% correct.
And so I'm like, you know what? This is good.
Mm-hmm.
It's not for me.
Yeah.
It's not hitting for me.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not going to watch this.
Yeah.
Right. But what I saw, I liked, and I liked Imani Vellani.
Mm-hmm.
Imani Vellani. She was very good. I think the problem, though, is that because that movie is made, that series is made for another demographic, you're asking that demographic to come into this movie,
right,
which is not the same tone, despite the opening,
right,
and is written for a totally different demographic,
right?
An older demographic. So then you've got a little bit of a tonal issue there. Brie Larson, I liked Captain Marvel, the movie. I didn't think it was super fantastic, but I liked it enough. And I don't mind Brie Larson as an actor, but there's something about Brie Larson in this movie where as I'm watching her, I'm like, everybody else seems like they're having a reasonably good time. Brie Larson looks like she's kind of like, okay, where do you need me next?
Right, right.
And it shows to me in almost everything that she's doing in this movie. Now, I know part of that is a little bit of the Captain Marvel character.
Yes.
But it just, if it is just the character, it still didn't land for me.
Right.
It still didn't land for me. And it got in the way of my overall enjoyment of this movie.
Right.
The other thing that got it in the way is that while Nia DaCosta has only had two films, so she doesn't necessarily have a style yet, I still consider her a very stylish director. And in watching this movie, and especially knowing how Marvel movies are made, Marvel movies, if you don't know, ladies and gentlemen, Vincent kind of just hit it on you. They're basically just big green screens, like almost every scene. Like maybe two or three scenes are outside, but most of everything is a green screen or a special effect that these people are walking around. And while I could imagine that for some directors, it might be fun to play with some of those toys, I get the sense that a director like Nia DaCosta, based solely on limited example, sample size, admittedly, kind of wants to play with a little bit more practical things.
Right. Well, she wants to direct.
She wants to, yes, exactly.
Yeah.
She wants to direct. She wants to set a scene, not create a scene in a computer.
Yeah.
And I see that bumping up against itself. And historically, reading some of the backstory, there was a little bit of, I think there was some behind the scenes where Nia DaCosta kind of like more or less detached herself from the movie near the end of it.
Yeah.
And without knowing the full story, I could maybe understand why she might have like, this is not really what I signed up for. Because in reading it, there were certain story elements she wanted to put in here. She was hoping to be able to play around with the X-Men. She was hoping to put in certain characters that were like siphoned off from her because they were going to be used in other films. So she didn't really get the full use of the Sandlot that she was hoping for. And then sometimes that can take the wind out of your sails.
Yeah.
You know? So it left me at the end with a film that I really wanted to sit there and like, cause I remember when you saw it in the theater, you was like, hey, it was fine. I was like, and I was looking at this movie to land on, hey, it's fine. You know? And I just couldn't get there.
Sure. Look, I still think, I watched it again today, and much like I watched it in the movies, and I said, hey, it's fine. And I was so happy that you were in charge of doing the plot summary, because I already forgot exactly what it was about. Look.
Oh, I'm sorry. I will say this, because I mentioned, I teased it at the beginning, the refreshing part about this movie.
Was.
The one refreshing part about this movie.
Was.
It is an hour and 47 minutes.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It gets in, it gets out.
Look, it's so many things that this film had to deal with when it comes to challenges of making this film. And you said a lot of them. The fact that this is part of phase two, where we've gone.
Is it phase two or phase three?
Whatever phase it is. The bottom line is.
Yes, phase three.
Marvel or Disney had this real confidence that people were going to keep sticking with these films. And while I'm not one to buy into, oh, there's superhero fatigue, as like X-Men 97 is the hottest thing in nerd world. And, you know, as soon as the next multiverse movie comes out, we're all going to fall all over ourselves. And the Batman did so well. I do think, much like comic series, like when a story arc ends, a lot of people say, okay, this is my stop. I'm not watching anymore. And I don't know, you know, I think there were too many things already in motion before Disney realized that. Like, I think they put so many eggs in these Disney Plus shows. As you mentioned, there are no less than three shows on a subscription channel that you have to know before this film starts.
Yeah, yeah.
Of those three shows, one of them was critically acclaimed. Like WandaVision, I think we all agree, this is a really, really good show. One of them, as you said, did not get the critical acclaim of WandaVision, but let's just call it what it was. That's because most of the critics are middle-aged white men. And as you said, Ms. Marvel was unapologetically a show for 13, 14-year-old girls.
Yes.
And frankly, I think it did its job
great. Very well.
And, you know, just I think the best part of this film was the Ms. Marvel part. And then one,
Secret Invasion
was one that was immediately forgettable.
Yes.
That no one really liked that much.
Very true. And the other thing you're forgetting, WandaVision, how many years ago was that?
How many years ago was WandaVision? Yeah. So you've got all of these balls going on. As you mentioned, when we talk about Nia DaCosta and we talk about a film like Little Woods, even a film like Candyman, which was more of a big studio film.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Like I think you have to be like Ryan Coogler or Christopher Nolan or like who gets to make a Marvel movie at this point without 90,000 lawyers and accountants and bean counters and the lunchbox people in the room. So like Nia DaCosta never had a chance to really execute her own vision. Brie Larson, I think you're absolutely right. You can see on her face, I'm here to fulfill this commitment. I'm here for this job, but I feel so bad for her because the amount of garbage she's had to deal with from these damn fanboys.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, she better than me. Like, you just had to go get a new actor. Like, you know, Captain Marvel will now be played by, you know, the dude who was the second Lionel. Now new Lionel is playing Captain Marvel. So, you know, I can't really blame her for just sort of, you know, okay, I'm here. And in the nerd's defense, like, you know, we won't get too nerdy with it.
You already went second Lionel.
There's always been a bit of artifice to the development of this Captain Marvel character.
Okay.
You know, Carol Danvers has been bouncing around comic books since the 60s.
Yes.
You know, she was the original Ms. Marvel, and then she, you know, in the 80s, 90s, they kind of revamped her. But right around 2012, which coincidentally is when phase one of the movie, of the movies ended, there was this huge bombastic revamp.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Where Carol Danvers takes on the Captain Marvel title. Mm-hmm. They gave her a costume that wouldn't be embarrassing to outside people who, you know, if you look at the pornographic outfits, they usually have character, female characters in the comics. Like, you're kind of embarrassed that you read comics. Like, and Carol Danvers' outfit was one of these outfits, like these kind of real low cut, high cut bathing suit outfits. And they said, why don't we give her an actual costume? But I do think there was a bit of the cynical view that Marvel was very consciously trying to develop something that they've never had, which is a Wonder Woman.
Exactly.
Like, Marvel's never had a Wonder Woman.
Never had it.
And we got to figure out how to have a Wonder Woman. And you know, you can't do Storm, A, because those rights are all tied up. And, you know, frankly, she's a black woman.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Black Widow doesn't really carry that heft.
No. No, you'd have to totally revamp the character.
Right. So, you know, we're going to create a Wonder Woman. And then when they create
a Wonder Woman, we mean like a powerhouse.
Like a powerhouse sort of feminist icon.
Yes.
Character that, once again, we can have lunchboxes and T-shirts and things and sell them to little girls.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think Captain Marvel always had an uphill battle before the film even is made. Like, just and you know, you and I are in these trenches, and you remember before when the film was announced. Hell, again, in 2012, when Carol Danvers got revamped, people immediately said what I just said. Oh yeah, Marvel is trying to get a Wonder Woman so that they can make a movie. And then lo and behold, 7 years later,
boom,
here it is. So It's look, if you like this stuff, I'm gonna say what I always say. If you like this stuff, it's no worse than, frankly, most of the Marvel movies, if we're going to be brutally honest. Like, if we kind of list the Marvel movies from Captain America Winter Soldier to whatever your worst film is, you know, this is right in there. You know, it's right
in the middle somewhere.
It's in the middle. It's a Five Guys burger. Like, nobody's going, oh, you're not going to take a date to Five Guys, but like it's Five Guys burgers. All right. Like, that's not a bad burger. You know, Tiana Paris she doesn't really do that much.
At the movie forgets her for a little bit.
You know, the movie forgets her. You know, I think she and Brie Larson do the best they can to try and establish this kind of relationship between the two characters. But as you said, it just feels undeserved.
Yeah.
Like, for the weight that you're trying to give this relationship, it just isn't. And this is somebody who watched WandaVision.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember these plot points and watched the first Captain Marvel.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say, there's a moment at the end between, and you know, obviously, you know who I'm in the bag for, but you know, between Tiana Paris and Lashana Lynch, that had more heft for me emotionally than anything I had watched in the past hour and 45 minutes.
That's true.
Like you, I thought Iman Vellani is fantastic. And I'm a big fan of Ms. Marvel. Like you, I said, you know, this isn't for me. But I enjoyed it. Like, I went on the ride. I enjoyed it. I love her family.
Yeah.
I love that the supporting characters. I love that entire dynamic. The one pure moment. Well, not one. I had like two pure moments of joy. Like, one of my pure moments of joy, there's a moment where her mother forbids her to have a space adventure.
Yes.
She says, you cannot have a space adventure.
That was cute.
And it's like, this feels like a good lived in moment.
Mm-hmm.
And then the one moment where I said, oh, yeah, a black woman directed this and wrote this, as you said, there is this conceit that they all have like a Freaky Friday bit. They switch places and they're trying to figure out how to get into sync between the three of them. So what's a way that three people can get into sync? We should double dutch.
Yes.
And the three of them double dutching, all jokes aside, I thought was actually charming because it looked like all three of them were actually doing it. Like, it looked like Brie Larson and Tiana Paris and Iman Vellone learned how to double dutch real slow, but just enough that it looked like it. And I bought that. Like, I liked that little moment.
I like the idea of that moment.
Yeah.
The execution of it, I didn't enjoy.
Like, as far as?
Like, I didn't think it was filmed all that great. So the joy that I think that they wanted you to feel, I'm glad you were.
Yeah, I felt it.
It didn't translate to me.
Yeah, I actually liked seeing the three of them. And that was the one moment where it felt like these three actresses, not just the characters, but the actresses were in this thing together. See, but
like that is all part of like a montage where they're showing how they're trying to, you know, work with this whole switching out, you know, and like use it, right? And there was something about the way that those that montage was filmed that it just didn't land with me, and it made me think, and maybe I'm giving too much credit to Nia DaCosta, but it made me think that, you know, I got a funny feeling this is another, you know, bone of contention for her because it looks like it didn't even look like it was edited. The montage was really even edited that well. Like I got the idea of the energy that they wanted to show. You wanted to show them being happy and getting used to it and and having like some pratfalls and things of that nature, but it never really lands. And I don't think that it was shot that great. And I don't think it was edited that well. And I will be very curious of how much of that is Nia DaCosta's hand. I do agree that I believe that the moment of them double dutching is definitely in the script. So I definitely hear you on Nia DaCosta writing that and putting that in there and maybe even putting them through their paces of knowing what's going to happen in this scene. And because there was talk about how, you know, they were all learning how to double dutch and do things of that nature. But I would be very curious of how much of her hand was actually on the actual filming of it.
I mean, I'm not going to fight you at all about you suspecting that there was some studio interference with the filming. Cause again, like, you know, again, at this point, who is going to make a Marvel movie and again, have the level of agency that made so many of the films that we like under the Marvel banner work? Like, who is going to be able to be Ryan Coogler,
right?
And say, I'm bringing my people, I'm bringing my costumers, I'm my cinema. Like, this is my, like, who, like it, how many movies has it been now?
This was the 33rd.
This is the 33rd movie. Like who's coming in to make the 37th intellectual property man film and then say, well, this is my movie. It's a closed set. This, like, you know,
there was another part that you were talking about the script, and then we'll shut this down a little bit. Nia DaCosta writing it had earmarks of it. There are moments where you're on the Saber space station,
sure,
right, and you're introduced to a couple of characters there. You're not really introduced to them by name, but they're allowed to show a little bit of personality, right? They're kind of like your window into the crew,
right.
And then the movie goes along and it comes to a point where everybody from the space station has to be evacuated.
Yes.
Right. So at this moment, you know, Nick Fury is like, now Samuel Jackson's got to run a little bit. So he runs a couple, you know, off camera. And then you're expecting these characters that you've been kind of introduced to for them to kind of like stand up because they're like, all right, we got to help get everybody off the ship because they work on the ship.
Yes.
And this is what they do.
Right.
They've been trained for this. But no, the people that help every one of these trained professionals in Saber,
yes,
get off the ship is the family,
yes,
from Jersey City,
yes,
that has zero space training.
No space training at all.
Yes. But they're the ones that are, yes, like, show you the way off.
Right, right. You know why? Because those are the ones that you care about.
Yeah, but I can almost see Nia DaCosta, the script setting up that it's going to be these other ones.
Oh, other people, and then they said...
At least for this moment, because it's not like a really big moment.
Well, you know, again, probably a test audience said, we don't really care about these people that we just met 20 minutes ago.
Yeah, so they get swallowed up by the cats.
We care about these characters that even if we just met them 20 minutes ago, the way that they play off of each other, they feel way more lived in.
I didn't like that. It bothered me.
That's what bothered you? That's the part that stuck in your craw.
It did stick in my craw, but I noticed it. I bumped up against it.
Oh my God, I so didn't care at that point.
Well, I mean, yes.
I didn't care. And you know, like I said, if I actually think they should have leaned in and kept the movie from Ms. Marvel's perspective. Like I think they should have just...
It should have actually been more true to being a Captain Marvel... Oh, just a Ms. Marvel movie.
Like, just go balls to the wall.
Mm-hmm.
This is an extension of the Ms. Marvel show.
Mm-hmm.
It's our target audience, which when you read reviews and you read, like, things have settled, especially now that it's on Disney Plus, where people can watch it
and find
without
it,
being
find
in
the
theater with these raging assholes.
Yeah, yeah.
That's who's found this film.
Mm-hmm.
13, 14-year-old girls.
Yeah.
Just go ahead and say this is a movie for this young female audience, unapologetically.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right.
And then, again, lean, you know, Lord knows it hurts my heart to say Tiana Parrish should have less of a role. But, like, Monica Rambeau and Captain Marvel are supporting characters.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the Ms. Marvel movie.
Yeah.
And because those are the parts that just sort of lift you out of it. Because because you're talking about it being a part. I'm doing my best not to, you know, it's like Dr. Heal yourself. Like, I'm talking about these nerds and I'm trying my best not to nerd out. But let's be real. This isn't even a part of the big hoo-ha.
Right, right.
Like, before what happened with Jonathan Majors, the big hoo-ha that's supposed to be ramping up is Kang.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
This don't have nothing to do with Kang.
Nope.
This is after Thanos.
And even the after credit doesn't have anything to do with Kang. It's got something to do with, it's probably going to be post-Kang.
Look, you're talking about the negotiation between Nia DaCosta and the studio. They're going to keep teasing because I don't think they have an X-Men plan, frankly. Like, I think they keep,
not yet,
because this they did an X-Men tease with Doctor Strange.
Yes,
they, you know, spoiler for Ms. Marvel, at the end of Ms. Marvel, they reveal that she's a mutant,
mm-hmm,
and they play the X-Men music.
Mm-hmm.
They have this, like, they keep kind of like. You're saying they're setting it up at the end of this movie for after. I don't think they actually have a plan.
No, I don't think. That's why I'm saying it. I think it's after whatever the Kang is.
Right.
Because Kang is the end zone.
Right.
Avengers,
but I'm saying they're going to make a plan after. Like, you know. You know, they threw Kelsey Grammer probably $100,000 to put that to show up. But there's absolutely no way.
And he doesn't even show up. It's actually all CG. It's just his voice.
Right, just use his voice. Like, there's absolutely no way I think Kelsey Grammer is going to be involved in the X-Men actually hits.
If he is to be believed, he says he wants to do it.
No. I know he wants to. But Kelsey Grammer is also in his 60s.
Oh, but
they're not going to make an X-Men movie for the next 10 years.
They could do his voice.
Okay, yeah. I bet you one American dollar Kelsey Grammer is not going to be involved when the X-Men actually happens.
That would be a shame.
I guess. Would be a shame. Oh, we can't find another.
I like this. I like Kelsey Grammer. I like his voice as Beast.
Sure. Got to find another white guy with a really nice voice. We'll go on one of these campuses and find one of these pompous professors and let them voice the beast. So even right. that, it doesn't really, you know, it's not part of the the thing.
The
it's,
big thing, right.
Right. It's just sort of right. here. So, but I guess the question, of course, is.
Is this a black film?
Well, I mean, I guess that's the first question. Is this a black film?
No, it's not a black film. It's not a black film. Tiana Paris, while on all of the covers and the movie posters and everything like that, and a prominent role in the movie.
Yeah.
I think to say that she is a co-lead, it would be a stretch. If anything, Iman Vellani is the co-lead.
Yeah, absolutely.
With Brie Larson. Lashana Lynch shows up for a cup of coffee and a couple of scenes. But no, this is not a black film.
I mean, you know, I'll invoke the Zora Neale Hurston, Seraphim the Swanee rule. It's a black director and a black writer. So if somebody wants to stick it in the black section, I mean, if Nia DaCosta's section is in the black section.
Well, then the Marvels
gotta,
would be there.
You got to stick Marvels in it. I also think it is worth noting that I believe, and I'm saying this in real time, Brie Larson might be the only white person in this movie. Like, I guess Old Girl's henchman is white.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. So I do think, and let's also be real, that's also part of the venom behind some of the venom that this film received. Like, there's a lot of brown people in this thing.
Yeah, it is.
You're like, right. Absolutely right. Like, a whole lot.
Yeah, absolutely right. Yeah.
So, you know, let's not act like that subtext.
That's very true.
Isn't working in this. It's not all black people, but it's a lot of brown people. And again,
that's a good point.
Yeah. So, you know, sure, I'll call it. Yeah. Sure.
It's a black. So you're going to call it a black film?
I'm going to call it a black movie.
All right.
It's Nia DaCosta's.
And, you know what? I forgot about. You're right. The Nia DaCosta directing it, Tiana Paris having a prominent role. You know, even if it is a tertiary lead. You're right.
I know they slid my girl some coins.
Who, Lashana?
No, Nia DaCosta.
Oh, well, so she made some. Yeah, she made
I
some
certainly
money.
Like some black dollars.
She definitely made some money.
Mm-hmm.
I'm seeing in the chat that there's more than a few people are saying that this is definitely a black film. To quote Sharon Eldridge, longtime missionary, Theodore Rex is a black film and this is not a black film. Okay, Sharon.
Yeah.
All right.
No, we're going with black film.
We're going to land on black film.
It is a black film, but the final question, of course, would be, is it a black film that you would recommend?
You know what? I couldn't get to you where I would say that I like the movie. But that being said, I would recommend the movie because I think it is fun enough. You know, I mean, if you 100%, if you're one of the people that like stickler for like the hard plot, you definitely wouldn't. You definitely need to like do some homework.
I have no idea what this film was about.
Yeah. Yeah. You may definitely need to do some homework. However, if you just are looking like I've got some popcorn, I've got an hour and 45 minutes, you know. It just, and I want something to watch.
Yeah.
On a Saturday, you know, folding the clothes, good, you know, good couple of laughs, couple of action scenes. Sure, why not?
Marvels. Yeah. And again, talking about its new life, I think it is the perfect movie to be on Disney Plus, where if there are some kids around and you're looking for something, you know, basically the TV to babysit some kids. And, you know, 10, 11, 12, I think it's a good movie to throw on for a kid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, like the whole musical section, it didn't hit me, but I could see a kid watching it and be like, oh, tickle pink.
We haven't mentioned the cats. Oh. And you know, they've got a bunch of cats and kittens that are alien cats and kittens.
Yeah.
Which to be fair, showed up in Captain Marvel.
Yes, yes, it's a continuation of that story.
So you know, that's a thing. Mm-hmm. I found the dance planet a little too cutesy for me.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I'm also just generally grumpy.
True.
So, you know, I can understand if people are sort of delighted and charmed by that. And that was another quick moment where it looked like Brie Larson was having a bit of fun for a second.
For a second.
But, yeah, I'd recommend. Sure. And then look. For all the talk, people are still watching these Marvel movies.
Yes, they are.
Like you talked about Captain Marvel, and people talk crazy about Captain Marvel, but Captain Marvel made $1 billion.
But yeah, they're going there.
Like it made $1 billion. So that's
that's not nothing. But that was 4 years ago, or little bit more.
Right.
And now you're looking at this movie, which did not make. This was considered not a successful film.
Right. But see, even that, like, we use these words like not consider, but it was based on its budget. But, you know, I think it has consistently been playing on Disney Plus. And then you also have to take into effect that they couldn't do advertising and publicity because of the strike. And, you know, as quiet as it's kept, nothing is really making no money.
Very few.
You know, kind of post-pandemic. So,
very few. All right.
But yes, I would also recommend. Sure, why not?
All right, ladies and gentlemen, there you have it. There's our review of The Marvels, which, as you've heard, is streaming on Disney Plus.
Mm-hmm.
Before we tell you what we're going to be watching next week, ladies and gentlemen, I invite you, if you're going to be in the Philadelphia area in the month of June, which is Black Music Month, then why don't you take some time to join the Michelle Mission and the Be Real Black Cinema Club at our live screening on Thursday, June 13th for The Five Heartbeats.
Got nothing but love for you, baby.
At Bryn Mawr Film Institute. Tickets are on sale right now at BrynMawrFilm.org. Excuse me. Mm-hmm. BrynMawrFilm.org. That's BrynFilm. Oh, no. I spelled it all wrong. I'm sorry. BrynMawrFilm.org. BrynMawrFilm.org. The Five Heartbeats. Tickets are on sale right now, Thursday, June 13th, 7 p.m. The Be Real Michelle screening series number two. Coming your way. Vincent and I and our good friend Stephanie will be in the building introducing the film and actually doing a live talk back after the film. We're going to be dressed to the nines. We hope you join us.
We're just going to have regular clothes on. Go ahead.
We will have regularly nice clothes to the nines on June 13th.
We will all have pants on.
All right. And if you want to contact Vincent and I, give us your thoughts about the show, ask us a question. Who knows? Email us at michaumission@gmail.com. That's michaumission at gmail.com. You can also find the Michelle Mission on your favorite social media, whether that be Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram at michaumission. And if you're watching us on YouTube, and you know you are, you can hit that bell, subscribe to the YouTube channel, hit the bell so you're notified when we go live, when we put up new videos on our channel. And please tell a friend about our show so that we can build up our numbers. We're a fledgling YouTube show, so we could use all the love we can get. Thank you very much for all of you who subscribe and sit in the chat every Tuesday and watch us as we stream live right here from Yunk Junk, Philadelphia's premier video podcast palace. If you want to book your time in one of the great studios here, you can email Dylan, our man Dylan at yunkjunk.com. That's D-Y-L-A-N at yunkjunk.com. All right.
Right
there. Can't spell it. All right. And the Michaud Mission is also a proud member of The Podglomerate, thepodglomerate.com. They make podcast work such as ours, which will be returning next week for Mother, May I Have Another One of Those Bad Black Movies.
Here we go.
And it's dubious of whether or not this film is actually a bad black film, ladies and gentlemen, but our special guest, he will be the judge of it. It is the noted author and comic book writer Gary Phillips, who will be joining Vincent and I next week as we review one of Vincent's favorite movies from the 70s, Bucktown, right here on The Michaud Mission. Until then, he's Vincent, I'm Len, and in parting we say,
we'll see you when it's time to meet again.
The Michaud Mission is produced by Len Webb and Vincent Williams, with co-production by Mo Poplar. Check out Mo's family travel podcast, Bon Amigos, at ashyfeet.com. Original music is provided by Alexa Gold. Visit Alexa Gold Music at Bandcamp for more of her melodies. The Michaud Mission is edited by Len Webb and produced for YouTube at YunkJunk. Visit Dylan at YunkJunk.com for more information.